Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. Do you need special skills to do something extraordinary? Or do you just need passion, a drive to keep going when others might have stopped? We're talking this hour about the kind of passion that motivates a person to build giant bug sculptures and travel around the country with them, or the grit it takes to immigrate to a foreign country and then run for mayor of your local neighborhood, or the perseverance to spend years working with local artists to create paintings that not only reflect the refugee experience, they literally cross the border from one painting to another. Here's artist Paul Hamilton in the documentary Breathe Free, describing his reaction to this cross-border idea.
I thought it was pretty gutsy, for one. I was wondering how that was going to work out. An artist painting on another artist's painting is sometimes, you know, not the way to go. You know, I've painted my whole life, basically, and I've never had anyone paint on a painting of mine. Didn't mean I was against it, but I was sort of like, wow, this is a new idea. And it encouraged me because anything new is good in art.
Joining me now is the woman behind that ambitious dream to let artists paint on each other's canvases, Lori Van Balen, the director of the Columbus Crossing Borders Project. Welcome to All Sides.
Thank you.
Also joining us is Columbus-based painter Michael Gnan, one of the participating artists in this year's show. Welcome to All Sides, Michael.
Good morning.
So, Lori, can you tell us about how you created this project 7 years ago and how it became known as the Columbus Crossing Borders Project?
Well, my original intention was to just create a short exhibit where I would invite maybe three or four of my colleagues in, and we would create an installation that would cross into each other's paintings. And using that metaphor of crossing borders, because typically artists tend to be very, they're protective of their work. They're territorial.
It's also like a solitary act.
Exactly. And so if you were, like Paul just said on that recording, not too many artists have crossed into other people's paintings. And so when we did this, my original intention was to just invite a few artists. But as I gained momentum and started getting the feedback that other artists wanted to participate, before I knew it, I had invited in 33 additional artists. And what was going to originally be maybe just a few months of an exhibit has turned into 7 years.
Can I ask what was the inspiration or how it became tied to reflect the refugee experience?
Well, I think art is a wonderful mouthpiece for initiating conversation. And in my case, I got tired of hearing about keeping people out. And my intention was never political. It was just from my heart. I truly felt that if most of us go into our past, into our ancestry, most of us came from somewhere else. Unless you're pure Native American, you came from somewhere else. So the idea of keeping people out was something that I wanted to address in my artwork, and how I felt that we could open our arms and somehow, in whatever way possible, help. So I took that into a sort of a concept that I carried around with me for about 6 months. And around the time of the presidential election, my father was in hospice, and he died the day after President Trump was elected. And I thought, you know, I could take my grief and put it into this project. And also, my father came from a family of immigrants. And so somehow it all seemed to tie in together. And before I know it, I had invited these artists in, and I gave them just a few months to produce this work, and it came together beautifully. So I think the project was meant to happen somehow, and it grew legs and just turned into something much bigger than I anticipated.
Michael, how did you get involved with the project?
Well, I again, it was feels like it wasn't that long ago, but yeah, 7 years ago, Lori approached me as one of the artists to do this. I was immediately interested. I always look at just kind of new creative ideas and concepts within an art project. But I think like a lot of people and a lot of people that were involved in this project, we do have a connection with people who have immigrated or who might be or know and have connections with these refugees. And so immediately I wanted to participate and I wanted to be able to help. And, you know, us artists are ones this is how we communicate and this is the way we can help. So it was immediately something that I wanted to be part of.
Your painting for this year's exhibit shows a woman holding her child and looking back while people all around her are rushing in the opposite direction. So can you tell us what's happening and where you got inspiration for it?
A couple inspirations. I mean, technically the piece goes back to a time where I was very inspired by a lot of Baroque and Renaissance style painting. But the idea is, you know, as you're moving forward in, let's say, the immigration process or as refugees, you're trying to find a new beginning and you're trying to move from a place that for some reason, whatever cause it might have been, you were forced to leave, usually not by your own choice. And you are coming one way, but you never want to forget your past. And I think that's what we really embrace a lot with the people that are bringing different cultures to our city, to our communities, to our country. That they are definitely looking back, bringing some of that forward along with everybody moving in one direction, never forgetting your past. And now the model for that was, she is a friend of mine who was a refugee herself and went through an experience having to leave Iran. And that is her son who was born here in America with her, who I had modeled for me for that. And I thought it was very appropriate to use her for this image.
So can you talk about the collaboration with the other artist? So who'd you collaborate with? How did you make sure your pieces were connected? And was it weird to let somebody else paint on your canvas?
Well, every artist chose a different way to approach that process. Some did, you know, directly say, okay, you can come to my studio. I will let you paint right onto mine. And every artist is going to be different because some are like, no, you cannot touch my painting. And others are like, yeah, I'm very open to having someone else work specifically with mine. I think like many things, this is going to be all about just, you know, communication between the artist, between your neighbor, and just talking about how you want to approach this. In my case, we discussed and we talked, we showed our sketches, we showed our preliminary beginnings of our paintings. We talked about what elements would be in there and what elements could possibly cross over into one. So for one of mine, there was, you know, maybe a figure in my neighbor's painting, and she had that as a primary element of her painting. I took that figure and was able to put it as one of the figures and characters in my
painting. Oh, so it's like an Easter egg in yours.
Yeah. It was. So she was wearing, you know, she's wearing a soccer jersey in a painting, and then I made sure that, you know, it's not quite as obvious, but she's part of the group that is, you know, that was working there and holding hands, and you could definitely tell that it's the same little girl that was in that image that is in mine. And then the other way, it's more about the landscape, the way it trails off, continuing then the physical landscape into the painting next door. And so in our case, we didn't really directly paint on one another, but like others, like you can see, and if you see the film Breathe Free, you can see a lot of those artists who are working directly together and others of us who just communicated.
Lori, you're one of the artists as well, and your piece shows a girl standing before a barbed wire fence holding a doll by the arm. So what was your inspiration?
Well, I wanted to make the child look fairly universal. Our exhibit is the artists and the type of work that they create is as diverse as the refugee community. And so I wanted my little girl to be that sort of universal child. And if you look closely, and it's interesting, we go into a lot of schools and visit with school children, and the kids often notice that the colors that the child is wearing are the colors of our American flag. Her pants kind of look like prisoner outfit, you know, like you might wear if you were in a refugee camp or in a prison. but they're the stripes, but it's reflective of the American flag. And so it was a general sort of theme of a child, and to imagine what it would be like to have to live in those conditions. You wouldn't wish that on anyone. And it's interesting because the barbed wire crosses into the painting next to mine by Hanihara, and his painting contains an American flag, and the barbed wire crosses right into the American flag.
What's it been like to collaborate with other artists over the years?
Well, I've always been a community organizer for the arts, and it was interesting because when I called together 33 artists, I knew it would be like herding cats, trying to get artists
It's
all in
quite the
school.
group project.
Yeah, and trying to get them all to show up. It was a wonderful collaboration. Not many of us did not know each other. We had heard of each other's names. Many of our artists are very well known. Some of them are local rock stars like Michael. And I felt honored to be able to do this and to work with them. And we were all addressing something that reflects our shared humanity. And like Michael says in our film, often you don't know what to do. You think, how can I help? And like I said, art instigates conversation, critical thinking, and hopefully support. And we've been privileged to partner with Community Refugee and Immigration Services. They contacted me early within this project. I got a call from one of their board members, and we have partnered with them. And it's just been wonderful to see the work they do, not only to work with the artists, but to work with these dedicated people.
You know, I kind of wonder, and this is a question for both of you, whether learning how to work with each other is, I don't know, almost an allegory for like how we have to work with the immigrants that come to our country. It can be complicated, it can be messy, but if you put in the effort, like maybe it does make something more beautiful than it would have been on its own. I don't know if I'm reading too much into it.
I don't think you are at all. I think that's absolutely correct. And it's rewarding. You know, you put that time in and it can be uncomfortable, you know, not exactly knowing how to engage with someone, but still trying to work together. That's what we have to do that within our community. But in the end, it does make the community a better place. And that's one is great thing about Chris, you know, the Community Refugee and Immigration group is that they are just trying to help in that way of, you know, connecting these people with their communities, with their neighbors, and, you know, having them work in the same way that we as artists did with people in collaborating in this project. It is very a direct connection of how you can read that and see that. And that's why this works so well, and us working with them has been just a really good thing.
Laurie, some of the artists are refugees themselves. So I'm hoping you can tell me a little bit about Dasa Harris. I hope I said that correctly.
Right. I met Dasha, and she was actually a friend of mine before I invited her in. And she came here from Slovakia, and she has lived here for quite a while now. And when her painting is really poignant, it could be a story of so many people, but it was something heartfelt. Showing a woman gazing out at an ocean with a child. And I think, Dasha, I think if she were here to speak about this, I think, she felt as a participant, humbled that she was able to share her art in that way. And I think she, her story is one of coming over here, from a country where there was a lot of repression, and coming over here and feeling that freedom of expression. And so I'm sure that shows in her art. One of our other artists, who is actually living in Nashville, James McQuash, was one of the Lost Boys of Sudan. And there is a local artist here, Bola Wang, who a lot of people know about, who was also one of the Lost Boys of Sudan. And they're actually very close. And they both use their art as a means of expressing what they've been through. And so, we have several people who in our group who are also immigrants. They weren't necessarily refugees, but they understand the immigration process and what it takes to acclimate to a new culture.
So for anyone listening who's like, okay, you've sold me. Where do I go to see this exhibit together?
Well, we've traveled for 7 years to community centers, places of worship. We've been to schools, and we will. I want to stress something that's very important. We are auctioning off all the original work right now. That online auction will end on Saturday during a celebration at the Chris offices, which we can, give the information. I think you have that.
Yeah.
But it's important to note that we have made very fine copies of the artwork so we can continue our advocacy. So to see us, the best thing to do would be to go to our website, columbuscrossingborders.com, and follow us. We also have a presence on social media. We will be Saturday, we will be at Chris. The originals will be there. You can't really tell the difference between the originals and the prints, but if you follow us on our website or you follow us on social media, you can see that where we're going to be. Also, we're easy to contact. So, we will visit many venues on invitation.
And if I, yeah, and I'll say there are links that you can get to the auction site that's live currently on the Columbus Crossing Borders website, but also the CRIS website, which is CRIS Ohio dot org. They have made an easy link to get to that auction as well. So if you go to their website, you can find out how to possibly bid, more information about that. And more ways to volunteer and find out how to help in all of this.
Yeah, I will say that the bidding started at $500 per piece. So if that's out of your price range, some of those prints might be an affordable way to bring some of this art
Well,
into your home.
the
I'm a big
prints.
fan of prints.
Well, the prints will not be for sale.
Oh,
The prints are just for display.
I gotcha.
Yes,
That's
yes.
unfortunate. You guys should sell the prints.
But yeah, that would be a
But
whole other project.
yeah, well, so if you want to see the artwork all together, then that's going to happen on Saturday at CRIS, which stands for Community Refugee and Immigration Services. So during the day, there's going to be a World Refugee Block Party from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. And then Saturday night, there is an evening of celebration for the Columbus Crossing Borders Project. That's going to be from 6 to 8:30 p.m. And that will be, I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, Lori, the last time to see all 34 original pieces displayed together.
Right. And the CRIS offices are located at 4645 Executive Drive in Columbus. And I believe that's near Worthington.
And that was Lori Van Balen, Director of the Columbus Crossing Borders Project. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
And thanks to Columbus-based painter Michael Gunan, one of the participating artists. You can see his paintings and others at the project Saturday evening. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up, how a Nigerian woman became the first black mayor of Upper Arlington. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Upper Arlington's population is about 1% people of color, but they recently elected their first Black mayor. She's the first Black mayor in a city where people of color make up about 1% of the population. But that's only one of her titles. She's also a law partner at Taflaw's Intellectual Property Transaction Group in downtown Columbus, and she's a mechanical engineer by trade, having previously worked for a Fortune 500 company. And she's also an author of a new book entitled Immigrit: How Immigrant Leadership Drives Business Success. Her name is Yukemi Owakasin Jeter, and she's sitting here in studio with me now. Welcome to All Sides, Mayor Jeter.
Thank you so much for having me, Anna.
That is quite a CV.
Sometimes I'm like, who are they talking about? Oh, wait, it's me.
So I want to start at the beginning. So you came to the United States, and more specifically, the University of Maine.
That's right.
As a Nigerian international student in 2000. Mm. And then what made you decide that you wanted to stay? And what made you decide you wanted to move from Maine to Arizona? That's like a real shift.
That's a real shift. You know, it's the immigrant journey, right? So I came to University of Maine. My dad had gone to Bowdoin, so he had some familiarity with Maine. I'd never seen snow a day in my life at that point.
Oh, my goodness.
And that sounded intriguing.
How was that first winter?
Not anything like it shows in Love Story. I think I watched Love Story a couple of times before I came. And just imagine I could roll in the snow and you wouldn't be wet. It's so illogical, right? So I got over snow pretty quickly after I had my first snowstorm. But, you know, you come as a student on an F1 visa, which is your student visa, and there's no long-term thinking about what your life or career is going to be, because every journey requires some kind of sponsorship or someone, especially with employment in the United States. So I had no idea that I was going to stay after college, but I was a mechanical engineer and got a job relatively quickly. After graduating, I had my OPT, which is another class of visa, which is your optional practical training, before my employer at the time decided to sponsor me for a H-1B visa, which is a highly skilled immigrant visa that allowed me to stay. And that's what took the journey from Maine to Arizona. It was job-related.
You also got away from the snow.
I did get away from the snow. Although I was in Flagstaff, Arizona, which, yes, you saw snow on the mountaintops, and there was some cold there as well, too.
So then you end up in Upper Arlington, Ohio, mm-hmm. in 2018.
Mm-hmm.
So what made you look around Upper Arlington and say, you know, I'd like to run for city council?
Well, to understand that, you kind of have to understand how I came to be in Upper Arlington. And I relocated to Upper Arlington in 2018 to take a job in-house with Nationwide's on your side. And so I took a job in-house, and part of that came with the relocation. And I think as humans, like everyone else, I was looking for a neighborhood and a type of house, but it wasn't attached to what it was. Just like, I needed mature trees because I loved older neighborhoods. I wanted to be close to downtown, nice parks and rec. And all of that just led to Upper Arlington. But I didn't know anything about Upper Arlington. I just
this looked like
house.
A nice place to live.
Exactly.
I get that.
That's about as much as I knew till I got there. And I got there, my daughter was just about starting kindergarten, so schools were important. So she started kindergarten. And within her first month in kindergarten, she came home and asked, Mom, can I straighten my hair for school tomorrow? As a five-year-old that has always worn her hair in her little Afro puffs, it was a very odd question. You know, it just as Black people in the Black community, we just don't straighten our hair, especially not that young. She had only straightened her hair once in her life before. And so it triggered me to try to understand what was going on for her. That's when I started to tune in to this new place I was living in, so to speak, and understanding that what she was doing was trying to change herself to fit in and belong. And that led to a journey of me trying to impact and influence the community that she was living in, and that we called home. I mean, this is the community I had chosen to raise my children in and for us to grow up in. And that's really what led the journey in 2021 to say, I'm going to run for office.
Aw, As a mom of like young girls, I felt that so viscerally, because the last thing you want is your kid to come home and have a sense of not fitting in with their peer group. It's so hard to navigate.
It is.
It like gets you in this special place somewhere deep in your stomach.
I'm so glad you understand. Yes, it is very visceral is the right word. It's like, okay, what can I do? Right.
Yeah. So you decided to run for office.
Mm-hmm.
What was the goal there? Was it to model that, you know, people who look like us can be like involved in this community, or to change the perception of like, what was the goal with running for office?
It was all those things. When we say two things, representation matters, and we say be the change you want to see, that practically means that we can't phone in change. We can't just write it in. we can't just keep pointing out all the things that need to be done without being the person that does the actual work. And so that was it for me. I needed to be in the rooms. I don't know if you've ever listened to the Hamilton soundtrack there's that song. No one was in the room where it happened, the room where it happened. You know that track? Oh, that, yeah. Listen, I can relate all of my life to a Hamilton soundtrack. Let's start there. But, you know, that just being in the room where those policies happen, where the discussion happens, what programming are we bringing into our Parks and Rec, right? Why does all the music have to be a certain way? Our procurement, like who's getting our money, right? When we're bidding out these contracts, all these things, these vast things. Yes, we can't change the makeup of the people that live in Upper Arlington, but there's other things we can do. Recruiting, right? The influence that our children feel, the information that we share, what they see. And so that's what I believed. It was a little naive, actually, when you think about the fact that I only lived in the community for 3 years, but I always call that the courage of the newcomer.
Yeah, I love that. And now you're the mayor.
Yes, yes. So I served for 2 years, and the Upper Arlington style of government, we're a council, city manager form of government. So the mayor is elected by my peers. So the other
council
members, yes. So after serving for 2 years, I just felt like we needed leadership at the very top. And so I went up for it.
What do your girls think of mom as mayor?
I should add, I have a son. He always says I don't talk about him often. I have a daughter and a son.
There you go.
Daughter caused me to run for office, but I do have this. My son was a year and a half at the time. For my son, obviously, he's 7 years old. It's more like, man, mom, you must really love this because you are gone a lot, right? That's the mind of a 7 year old.
Yeah.
My daughter's 11 years old now. And what she sees is modeling of, she says all the time, when you say be the change you want to see, I'm actually seeing you do the things. We say it and it's just so euphoric. It feels so out of touch, but it's, you have to get in the arena. And I think that's what she sees and appreciates. And listen, she wanted to start a petition for changing the dress code in school. So I don't know if this is good or bad.
I'll circle back with you in a couple of years when she has gone through her teenage years.
Okay, please.
She's got a drive. No one's going to tell her what to do. Yeah, I have one like that where you're like, you're gonna lead a Fortune 500 company or a prison gang, and I just don't know which one it's gonna be yet.
Right. And I just need to live with you till you're 18, so you can let's just get through 18 first and then go do that.
Yeah, no, they're great, but they're very driven.
Yes.
You know, and that all culminates in your book, mm-hmm. Immigrit, mm-hmm. which I love a good play on words, so thank you. What suddenly said to you, you know, I've worked for Fortune 500 companies. I have an advanced degree. I'm mayor of Upper Arlington. Like, where did the book fit into this?
Yeah, you know, so when I initially won council in 2021, I had the distinct honor of giving the commencement speech in 2022 back at my alma mater, right? And that came from the honor of winning city council. And so I returned to campus after almost 20 years. Wild, right? So it's a full circle moment. And my American story is the immigrant story. So when you think about giving a speech to, you know, new graduates, you're trying to connect with them and trying to remember what life was like when you were sitting in that seat. And for me, life was very unknown. Again, being an immigrant, being most of your life is controlled by visa statuses and rhetoric around immigration. But ultimately, I think what I discovered is that being an immigrant has been my superpower through this journey. And so I'm giving the commencement speech that tells them about this immigrant journey. And a lot of it has forced me to live life off script and persevere. It takes a lot of grit, resilience, all these qualities that, by the way, are leadership qualities, right? But we so tie the immigrant story to immigrant struggle, and we don't think about it as immigrant leadership, right? And so I give this speech and I get off the commencement stage. Listen, writing a book has never been in my goal list anywhere. And I get off the commencement stage and an international student approaches me and tells me point blank, till your speech, I'd never considered my immigrant experience as arming me with leadership skills. And I thought, my God, that is sad. But I get it because I was there. Like, it took a little while before I had a boss ask me whether I had project management skills. And I was like, have you ever tried to project manage all your immigrant statuses and what lawyers you have to reach out to, when, what dates you have to give stuff
have to? Have you navigated the federal government bureaucracy? That is a good project management.
Believe me, I have project management skills. And so it took me aback. But, you know, and this student said, you should write a book. And I didn't think much about it, but I, you know, when something has been placed in your heart, it just haunts you. And I started to read about and find out only 3% of our Fortune 100 CEOs are immigrants. Meanwhile, our population of immigrants is like 14%. Most companies, almost half companies, were started by immigrants. So, you know, when you start to see things, you can't unsee it. And that's what led me to write the book.
One of the interesting things that I learned in prepping for this and learning all about you was that 95% of executives say they see a value in hiring immigrants, but only 5% say they're doing it strategically.
Yeah.
What do you think is the disconnect there between seeing the value and then actually making an effort?
Yeah. I think they are biases in how we see leadership. I talk a bit about accent bias and foreign education bias, right? I mean, pull a six-year-old from the playground and ask them what you think a leader looks like and what you think a leader sounds like. Chances are they're going to think a white male. So it's very, very ingrained in how we pick leaders. And so I think it starts there. The accent, how they present, where their education came from, all those biases we need to start dismantling first before they can start to really intentionally pick immigrants for leadership.
So then that leads me to my final question, which is, what are you going to do next?
And are you saying you haven't done enough? Is that what you're saying?
No, I am not saying that. It's just sort of the question of, you know, where do you go from here? What's the next big thing?
You know, I have no idea. It's interesting how my life has worked. My life has always been driven by advocacy for others, serve others. Again, you hear the story of my daughter, you hear the story of the student that spoke about this, that led me to write that. I just strongly believe that, you know, just give of our talents and our skills in the ways that we can, when we can. And so I don't know what next opportunity will arise, but I'm sure someone will drive that for me, and I'll be so intrigued that I'll pick up the mantle and do it.
Any ambition for higher political office?
Oh, my goodness. Have you seen how mess everything else is? You know,
it might be the kind of place that could use a little immigrant.
You know, it's quite interesting you say that, because I touched very briefly on it. Just even in our in the political sphere that's talking immigration, half the time it's people that have never navigated any type of immigration status trying to legislate on immigration. So we certainly need to see more immigrants in that space. Now, if I can help get them elected, I will. Should I be the one? I don't know.
That's a question for another day,
then. Yes, yes.
That's Yukemi Owakasin Jeter, president of Upper Arlington City Council, where she serves as mayor. And she's the author of Immigrit, How Immigration Leadership Drives Business Success. Thank you so much for joining us today on All Sides.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, there are some mighty big bugs down at the Dawes Arboretum, and we're talking to the man who created them. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. You know, we're all a little bugged by bugs in the summertime. We slap mosquitoes, shoo flies, crush spiders. But there's a place down in Newark where you can get really close to some really big bugs. And don't worry, they don't bite. These bugs are made out of trees, and they can be as large as 25 feet long, 10 feet tall, and weigh up to 1,200 pounds. David Rogers is the creator of this traveling exhibit, and he spent 30 years taking it across the country. It's now at the Dawes Arboretum in Newark through August 25th. Welcome to All Sides, David.
Welcome. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
So this is a huge exhibit to not only create and maintain, but to set up and break down. So I'm curious about how it all got started. So what made you wake up one morning and decide to build giant bugs?
Well, I think it was a couple of different mornings, but I'd done different types of construction. I've worked for a bunch of different woodworkers, different disciplines, wooden sailboat maker, cabinet maker, house carpentry. But it wasn't until I met an individual named Barry Schwartz is his name. And he was making furniture out of willow saplings in this barn in the town where I live. And my eyes just went big. And I was like, what, you know, cause there was no tape measure. It was a lot, there's a lot less rules. As a matter of fact, there are no rules to making rustic furniture.
That's so fascinating. And you made the decision then to use all natural forest materials and mainly four different types of trees. Can you give us a sense of how you put these together and what they ultimately look like?
Well, in the very beginning of the project, when I came up with the idea, I was approached by a botanic garden in the Dallas Arboretum in the early 90s. And they said, well, I'd been building branch dinosaur pieces, you know, life size, 40 foot long, 15 feet.
Oh my gosh,
tall.
Where are the branch dinosaurs?
Interestingly enough, one of them is in the town of Pound Ridge, New York. That was moved from a private property. They had enjoyed the piece on their property for about 30 years, and they sold the property, and they called me and said, what would you think about helping us or orchestrating how to move this piece? We're giving it to the town and they want to put it in a park. So it's an interesting experience moving a 40-foot dinosaur.
I bet. Yeah. So the bugs, though, they're not as big as a 40-foot dinosaur, but they're still, I mean, they're big.
Yeah, they're big. And I think so. What happened for me was, because it was a botanic garden reaching out for something other than dinosaurs, and I started thinking about subject matter you would find in a garden, in a horticulture environment, and I immediately seized on the idea of the insects, and that in some ways, and I can't coin the idea or the phrase of them being the hidden gardeners, you know, almost take
granted. Yeah, no, they are, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, we see them or perceive culturally them as pests and bloodsuckers, and you can get a disease from a tick, you know, all these terrible things. And that's all true. But the more important role that they play actually in, on the whole is way more important. Without them, we wouldn't be here.
No, I agree. So there are 10 different big bugs right now on the grounds of the Dawes Arboretum. There's a giant praying mantis weighing in at 1,200 pounds, a super-sized dragonfly. What else is out there?
We have praying mantis. There's a damselfly. There's a, we mentioned, assassin bug. There's a large ladybug that's about 8 feet wide by eight, you know, about 8 feet by 8 feet. And a spider web, and I doubt I'm recalling exactly.
I think there's an ant too, right? Yeah, there's a giant ant.
Yeah, there are actually three ants. They're never a one ant. I figured out. Once upon a time, the very first exhibit had five ants, but I figured out that three. You have to have more than one because you never really ever see a solitary ant.
Although, that's true.
Yeah, I mean praying mantises. You never see big groups of them. So I decided to just do one of them.
No, that makes sense. I have to wonder, have you ever seen people react to it for the first time? I'm particularly thinking like when little kids see them for the very first time.
Yeah, that's about my most favorite moment. I sometimes try to be anonymous. I don't want to be the artist guy. And just so I could hear and see kids of all ages, I like to say, and they're sort of the immediacy, you know, the response, is just genuine, you know, without all the science stuff that does go with it. And I have created something that has a terrific educational platform, but the idea of just seeing them for the first time, you know, a lot of the pieces are located in a way, and I always say, how do you hide a 20-foot tall praying mantis? And it's pretty tough to do, but sometimes we do it in a way that it's not right. None of them are out in a big turf area like statuary. You know, I work directly with the gardens about a year before the exhibit comes in to go over where we're going to put these pieces and how are we going to, how are we going to hide the praying mantis?
Yeah, no, I love that because it's kind of, you're trying to integrate them into the landscape as though they were real bugs.
Yeah, they were real bugs. And so I guess I just want to return to an early question about what actually happened and why I chose bugs. So
yeah.
If you don't mind. And I thought of doing these large insects, but on a dinosaur scale. I really liked working at that scale. So I went from making rustic furniture that was all about form and function to one day making a dinosaur sculpture behind my cousin's house in Vermont, bent over sapling, destroyed in an ice storm. And he wanted me to cut it down. I saw something else. I saw the spine of a beast, of a some kind of something. And you know, whereas I was very happy and content making rustic furniture, there was endless room for creativity and making things that I wanted to make. But I made this dinosaur and it just turned my head right. And I said, oh, now I really know what I'm going to do. I'm going to be a dinosaur builder. And that morphed into this idea of building sculptures, dinosaur scale. And so they debuted at Dallas and I had to build them here in New York on Long Island. In the studio space that I had at that time. And I had to make them so they were modular. So there's a steel armature inside the sculptures. And it's a very simple, elegant design. A friend of mine helped me out with at first. And so that's how we moved the show. So the ants, you know, all the pieces come completely apart. And then they're packed into all 10 sculptures will fit in a 26-foot straight truck.
Oh, wow. That is some clever packing. What does assembly look like? I assume you have a crew that comes out and helps you put them together and take them back down at the end.
We actually, there are members of the garden staff that get assigned to work with us. Us, me and my wife, Terry. So we, every time we install the show, we have a new group of people that don't have any familiarity with.
Oh my goodness.
So it's actually really fun. I mean, we just finished the second install. We opened doors, and then we had a week or so off here back home, and then we went out and to Pennsylvania, to Pittsburgh, and installed another exhibit there at the Pittsburgh Botanic Garden. Some of the same sculptures, and then the pollinators. So we had five big bug sculptures and five pollinator pieces that went in.
Wow.
But that's the most, I really like that week, that install week, you know, working with a new crew. And the thing about doing the show is that I get to see it, you know, I've yet to grow bored doing it. I mean, if I don't, that week when we're installing them and the first visitors don't even know, because the show hasn't been advertised as opening in a week, they don't realize that these pieces are going up, you know, during that week. So we get a lot of people say, what is this? Where did that come from? I mean, who made that, you know? And so I usually kind of stand back a little bit. I don't want to be the guy, you know, I mean, I am the guy, but I was like, I want to hear what they say.
Unfiltered.
Yeah, unfiltered and spontaneous. You know, they get the fun, you know, because one of my favorite artists, Calder, Alexander Calder, you know, when asked what was the meaning or what was he trying to accomplish and what was his mission. And his statement was still my favorite was he said, I wanted to make things that were fun to look at. And I always thought that's a really, really simple, straightforward way of creating art and not thinking, not over intellectualizing it at all.
And for those wondering, I want to let you know that the Dawes Arboretum is open Monday through Thursday and Sunday from 8 a.m. to 7 p.m. They're also open Friday and Saturday from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. General admission is $10 for adults and $5 for kids 5 through 15. And this, you can see the giant bugs through August 25th. So if you want to go see them, you still got a couple of weeks, but you should head down to the Arboretum and check them out. I want to say, so what else is with these displays, right? Because it is the bugs, but then there's all this science and other things that go along with the displays. So is it like you learn about ants by the ants, you learn about praying mantises by the praying mantis? Is that like, what was the thought process there in providing extra materials around the bugs?
Well, I would like to say initially, I didn't have a mission statement. I was making sculptures that I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And the challenge of creating them, like when you say you're going to make a 20-foot long ant, and then somebody gives you some of the funding to do that, and you go, well, how do I make it? You know, like, how big is its head in relationship to its thorax, relationship to its abdomen? Well, how tall would a 20-foot ant? And those answers.
How do you scale it? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, those questions needed answers, and I made a bunch of dinosaurs and a lot of furniture, but you know, I was really in a new pasture, and so that part of it, that aspect as an artist was the challenge of doing that, and then making them modular on top of that was really fun, and I still get a lot of energy. I still get very happy and when I'm challenged, or even now the pieces have been out there in the gardens for so many years, I'm still looking at how do I make the dragonfly wings flutter more, you know.
Do they actually flutter in the wind?
They do flutter in the wind.
Oh my goodness.
They're on a float in a big pond, and it has an anchor, but the float still moves around, and if the wind is right, those wings will flutter. Which, you know, is a...
That's awesome.
Yeah, and I the idea of wind animation or wind animation is a terrific thing. But I also work, I think, on some of the designs, because they're stationary pieces, you still want to create something that makes the viewer see that they're in motion, you know, even though they're not. And so that's another challenge that I work on, you know, how do I make these ants look like they're marching, you know, because there's three, you know, and they're in a line, that they're definitely headed somewhere to the picnic around the corner.
You need to, I don't know if you're familiar with the Longenberger basket here in Northeast Ohio, but there's a basket making company, and they built a very giant building that looks like a Longenberger basket. So the ants would probably look perfect placed outside of the giant picnic basket.
One of these trips, I'll have to take an extra day and go see that in person.
It's like a 5-story picnic basket. It's huge.
Wow.
But...
I like big.
Yeah, so I guess my final question for you is, what's next? What do you think, or do you not know what you might build after you've tackled dinosaurs and pollinators and big bugs?
Well, not that I feel stuck in the format I'm in. I mean, I'm actually returning this summer to finish a dinosaur sculpture, which I started last summer, and it's not completed, so we're going back up there for another month to work on that piece. I didn't ever expect to make another dinosaur. But I guess some of the things that I think about for the future really have nothing to do with insects or dinosaurs. It has a lot to do with a lot of things I learned about the materials I work with, that I choose to work with. And I don't know, I don't wanna, it'd be hard to describe some of the things that are in my head.
That's all right, though, because we are actually running out of time. But okay. We'll have you back whenever you figure out what the next thing is. That was David Rogers of David Rogers Big Bugs. The exhibit is on display at the Dars Arboretum in Newark until August 25th. Thank you so much for your time today, David.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And that'll do it for this hour of All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.